This week on Writers, Inc.
Almost no matter which way you go, except for a handful of outliers, it seems like quality comes through quantity. So many writers are just have a pile of spec scripts or in screenwriting before they to kind of take off, or it might be that you're keeping up a blog before you get your book published. It's all this kind of an apprenticeship type way of life till you get to where you really find your voice.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
J.P. Reinflush.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. Kevin is MIA. I know he said he was going to be somewhere, but I have a habit of like tuning him out, you know, two or three words after he starts talking. So like, I don't know where. I don't think it was anything too important. No more surgeries or anything like that. But
no, I don't remember either. So sorry, Kevin.
we're rooting for you, whatever it is. I got an email from Ingram Spark. I'm guessing a lot of you guys have seen this too, but they're rolling out a new program with direct links. So you can basically create a link on your website that will go directly to Ingram Spark. I haven't looked at the back end of this, but it does say that they will ship for you, which is a huge time saver. Have you guys looked at this at all? Like, I'm just curious where the links actually take you. Like, is it an Ingram Spark page, or do you get to customize a landing page? I'm curious how that part works.
I haven't looked at it yet, but this will definitely be a really good tool for anybody who isn't using like Shopify or Fourth Wall or anything like that, and they want to get their books available to people through direct. Like, that's fantastic.
Well, there's no charge either, is there, from Ingram Spark?
I don't think so. I didn't see any.
Yeah, because Shopify, I think, well, I mean, it's not huge, but I think Shopify is like $20 a month if you go that route.
Yeah, that's why I chose Fourth Wall, but that's more for creators like YouTube and Twitch. And so I luckily got through that system, but it's pretty much free. So it's a really nice program to use. But this Ingram thing is really nice for another step for authors to really get to direct sales. So
cool. Good to see them doing something like that. What's in the news?
Well, we've got the Authors Guild exploring blanket license for artificial intelligence companies. So the Authors Guild is considering an opt-in blanket license for AI companies to use authors' works in chatbot development, with James Patterson funding the initiative. The proposed model includes fees for using works as training material and restricts AI outputs from heavily borrowing from existing content. About 38% of surveyed guild members showed interest in participating in the licensing model, which emphasizes both control and compensation for those authors.
Have any of you guys read the fine print yet?
No, and I'm curious about how this works, because is it just like they're using it anyway, so they're trying to get some protection, which is kind of what it feels like to me. So I'm just curious, how does this restrict them from borrowing content extensively?
You know, yeah, I'm honestly not sure, and I'm lazy, so I was just going to ask Jim when I talk to him next, because it's like this is not something I expected him to do, so it's kind of neat that he's involved, and knowing the way his mind works, like he's definitely got the author first, and whatever framework is developed based on this. But I'm going to dig into it a little bit and take a look at it. I mean, I'm not opposed to licensing my data. I mean, I do want to be compensated for it. I want to know what's actually being used and what's not. It still feels like a runaway train to me, though. Like, you just sign on the dotted line and you're never really going to know what's really being used. And like, they don't necessarily have to tell you unless it's built into the entire system somehow, sort of like the way the blockchain works. And I've got no clue if that's what this is going to do or not.
Yeah. I would love an update on that. But yeah, I'm just wondering if it gives some legal protection if you do find that your work has been used.
Yeah. I think that at the end of the day, like, signing up for something like this, as long as you read through the fine print, puts you ahead, because more than likely they're going to use someone somewhere is going to use it anyway, especially if your name is known. And so putting some protection behind it, as long as you read the fine print, is probably why people like James Patterson are jumping on this, because it puts authors back in the space and puts their voice kind of there and present. So yeah, interesting to see. I would like to know more, which we will learn in the future. Next up in the news, a British Library begins restoring digital services after a cyber attack. British Library is gradually restoring its main catalog containing over 36 million records in read-only format after a major cyber attack 11 weeks ago. Full recovery of all services is expected by the end of the year, and it really is acknowledging a significant impact on researchers. The ransomware group that looked into this claimed responsibility on October 31st, resulting in stolen employee data being sold on the dark web. Keating assured the steps being taken to restore full functionality, including access to special collections and public lending right payments to authors.
I would love to see the video of whoever clicked on the attachment in their email that actually sparked this entire ransomware thing. Because it doesn't have to happen, but that's basically how it does happen. Like somebody just clicks on an attachment. It's just a PDF or whatever it might be, then takes over that computer. And then most of the time it will use their address book to send out that same thing to whoever they've got on their contact list. And it just propagates through the system. So I'm guessing that's what happened here. Nice to see them getting their house back in order, but it probably should have happened in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I think usually they say the weakest point in any sort of data security is the person, because people are willing to answer the phone and answer questions. And it's just a lot of be careful who you're talking to and what you're giving away.
Yeah, this actually happened. This happened at the hospital where I live a few months ago, and everything has been down in the hospital and procedures were delayed. Anything that wasn't like an emergency was delayed, you know, and I go for my son every 3 months because he's type 1 diabetic, and they're like, when's his birthday? What's his dosage? Like, they're just so hamstrung without, and it's just been amazing. They still don't have email and it's been months, so I don't know how that happened, but it is a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that something like this, with something so big and vast, the potential that it could go down and that, you know, a year out, they might still be paying out authors for things that might have been, you know, reserved or borrowed a couple months ago, really goes to show that authors should make sure that they're diversifying, because something could wildly go down at any time. And that's just the unfortunate realm that we live in with cybersecurity.
Can you imagine if somebody at Amazon actually clicked on that link and like it propagated through the Amazon system? AWS and everything. Like the whole world would basically come to a grinding halt if it made it into AWS. I'd be really curious to see what kind of security they have on those types of systems, because it hasn't happened. So like they're obviously doing something that, you know, regular companies are not. Right. I'm wondering what the difference is.
Right. I would say don't give the ransomware hackers ideas, but I'm sure they've already tried. So, you know.
Yeah, true. All right. Last up in the news, the future of fiction. Wattpad research reveals generational shift in reading habits, skepticism of AI and publishing. So this was actually an article that was shared from the Hot Sheet. But Wattpad's survey reveals a notable shift in reading preferences among younger generations, a strong indication or inclination toward online fiction, especially for diverse and inclusive content. The majority of readers, being 92%, believe in human involvement and that being crucial for writing and the production of books, showing skepticism towards AI and publishing. Younger readers prefer digital formats like web novels and web comics, with 65% of Gen Z and 71% of millennials engaging more compared to older generations, driven by the diversity of these formats and what they offer. Despite the potential of AI in publishing, authors show concern, with 79% not using AI tools in their creative process, fearing impacts on monetization and inclusive storytelling.
Have either of you ever used Wattpad before?
No. Yeah. I mean, I've used it as a reader, but
I mean, I looked at it. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't even gone that far, but so you've never written on it before. Have you ever used any online platform like that? Well, I know you're doing Serial stuff, right? Or you're doing the Amazon.
Yeah. We both do Vella, which is, I guess, similar, except paid, right? Wattpad you can do free.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, like we've done Kindle Vella. I think we both played around with like Patreon. There's Gumroad, all of these other places, but
Fictionate. I've looked at some like, novel, I forget, something else. Yeah, I've looked at a couple of things.
And there are lots of readers there.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is, are they going to Wattpad because it is free? Like, is that what's driving them there over something like Vella? Or are you still seeing a mix of them? Like, do you have any idea on Vella, like what your audience is made up of? Like what age group or male, female, any of that kind of stuff?
Not really, no. But I get the sense that there aren't as many readers there as there are for Wattpad.
Yeah, I would agree.
Well, that is telling.
Yeah. I did think this was interesting, though, looking at the other studies that we've looked at, that younger readers want physical books, but then they also want online serial platforms. I can't remember the generation overlaps, but yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. I wonder, especially because of this interest in like web novels and web comics and those being serials, more or less. I wonder if it's the availability or the ding every week of like, hey, a new chapter's up, or hey, you know, you get to be the forefront to see the story unfold. I wonder if that sort of involvement is what interplays between the interest of web novels versus the interest of physical books, and the drive for that as like the show for, you know, Instagram or TikTok and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if like them being separate is kind of key here, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And I wonder if it's the social aspect, right? Because the physical part is also social because you're on TikTok, you're getting comments when you have physical books. Serial is social because you're commenting or you're interacting mm-hmm. with the webtoon. So I wonder if it's that social and engagement piece that they're looking for.
I feel like I need to grab my nieces and nephews and ask them. Like, I don't get it. Like, I've looked at Wattpad before, but I don't feel relaxed reading on something like Wattpad. Like, it doesn't give me that relaxation that I get from picking up a physical book. And like, and I still get that from, you know, using a Kindle, you know, but for like, even right now, like I'm working with co-authors, when they send me pages, I can't read it on my computer. I have to either print it out or I'll forward it over to my Kindle and I read it on the Kindle. I don't know why, but like, it just, for some reason I need to read that way. I can't do it on a screen, but you know, they've obviously been brought up reading on screens, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with the whole AOL being a common thing in like middle school and high school.
You've got mail.
Constantly had like web comics and web novels. So I think my generation is just super used to reading that kind of stuff online.
Yeah. My niece is a Wattpad fanatic. And I remember when I wanted to start doing serials, I asked her, what do you love about it? She reads true crime. She loves murder. So she's on there reading about that all the time. And she said she likes that they can put pictures in wherever they want mm-hmm. and they can use a lot of them. And she's like, and I can visualize what the people are wearing and where they are. So she really loves that aspect of it. Yeah. Hi, Ava.
This episode is brought to you by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. AutoCrit takes you far above standard grammar checking or cookie cutter guidance. Instead, it's like having an experienced editor in your genre watching over your shoulder to help you deliver great writing that keeps your audience trapped in the story. You can even compare your writing style to more than 100 best-selling authors right down to the word level, so you can see what the best in the business do to keep their storytelling clean, clear, and crisp. Listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can now take advantage of lifetime membership for one single fee. That's right, no renewal fees.
Hi, this is JD Barker. I've used AutoCrit for years, and not only has it improved my writing, but it's been a crucial tool with aspiring authors that I've mentored. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just beginning, it'll help you find your weak spots and weed them out. Give it a shot with your latest project. Trust me, your editor will thank you.
Head to autocrit.com/JD to get your lifetime membership. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
And with that, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got Brock Swinson on. Brock is an interviewer for Creative Screenwriting. It's a podcast. He's interviewed everyone from Aaron Sorkin to Ethan Hawke. He's also an author, and his latest book is called Ink by the Barrel, Secrets from Prolific Authors, and he's going to tell us all about it. So here he is, Brock Swinson.
Okay, so we are chatting about your book, Ink by the Barrel, a series of lessons distilled from hundreds of books and interviews about the craft of writing. And it incorporates your perspective as both an author and a filmmaker. Can you tell us a bit about why you wanted to write this book?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely like a world of knowledge. I wrote it kind of, I'm up to like almost 450 episodes or something now of the podcast. And I also write for Creative Screenwriting Magazine, so it's attachment. So it started as screenwriters But when I got the okay to kind of use the audio, I could branch out and talk to authors and chefs and musicians and whoever. It's still mostly writers though. Yeah, but I think I just became obsessed with the idea of being prolific. Like it seemed to me that almost no matter which way you go, except for a handful of outliers, it seems like quality comes through quantity. So many writers are just have a pile of spec scripts or in screenwriting before they to kind of take off, or it might be that you're keeping up a blog before you get your book published. It's all this kind of an apprenticeship type way of life till you get to where you really find your voice.
Yeah. And you've divided your book up into three parts. So you have defending your time, finding your voice, and then discovering your process. And these are things that, as you said, you believe are needed to be prolific and to have success as a writer. So yeah, like you said, you got to defend your time. That's where we start. And you call it ruthless prioritization. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one, right? Like that's a really tough thing. So that came, I mean, I probably heard it a dozen times, but the time that stuck out was this guy named Michael Landon, who writes a show called Looking on HBO. And he was just saying like he didn't really start to get words on the page regularly and get noticed until he defended his time. His example then was like, you know, maybe not going out for that beer with friends when there's time to write or something along those lines. I think it changes over time. Like when I was in my 20s, I would write at night. Now that I'm in my mid-30s, we have a one-year-old. I have to write in the morning or else it won't get done. So I think part of it's that. It doesn't mean that you're completely ruthless all day and a terrible person. It just means that like you need to be selfish a few hours a day. And whatever your craft's going to be, that could be writing, that could be fitness, like whatever those things are that kind of helps you do the other things. I think that's really important to defend that time.
Yeah, I agree. And I forget who it was, but the first time I came across that, it was like, write down what you do in a day. And then when you don't do it, right, I choose not to prioritize. And just writing down, like, I choose not to prioritize writing. That hurts. So yeah. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, you really, that's part of the ruthlessness to it. Like I heard this a long time ago too. It's like, don't prioritize your schedule, only schedule your priorities. That really makes you change things. Like, so a big drastic thing I'm doing now, and I've got a little community I'm kind of talking to, and I'm published on Medium and stuff like that. I'm actually writing my second book now, but I'm kind of like decided that I just wasn't getting where I was going. And I had so many projects that I wanted to do in addition to like client work you have to do because I'm in copywriting. I decided to give up like the things that were time sucks for me or that changed my day. So that was like junk food, social media, and television. Those are cheap dopamine hits that like if you're constantly getting that feed, you don't get the same reward of like writing or even doing the dishes or something like that. Like I'm almost like, it's almost like harnessing the power of boredom. I'm so bored that I'm ready to go do some more work because there's nothing to like, just kind of take your time, entertain you that way.
Yeah. And you quoted Neil Gaiman about that, who said, I'm allowed to do anything I like as long as it isn't anything. So I give my self permission to write, but writing's more interesting than doing nothing.
You can write or you can do nothing, which gives you like a really good like way to think about things. And again, it's like, you know, I'm trying to kind of be drastic and be productive all day, but I did a writing challenge with about 1,000 people. A lot of people just hadn't finished their first short story or whatever it is. And the goal was just to try to write every day. And I probably said that quote like 5 times. It was like a video training I did. It's on my website and everything. But the goal is just to develop the habit. And it doesn't have to be this long, crazy thing. You don't have to be Stephen King. You probably can't start and write 4 to 8 hours a day or whatever it is. You probably want to start with like, I'm going to sit at my desk for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes and just do that every single day at the same time. And eventually those things will kind of click into place.
Yeah. Another thing that you talked about that I want to touch on is about annihilating writer's block by examining how you approach the work. So you said there are two paths a writer can take, one of dreadful pain and one that is playful. Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a big one. So there's it comes from Elizabeth Gilbert in the book Big Magic. She talks about a playful trickster and a tortured martyr. I think so many movies portray the tortured martyr, the person who's just grinding in the dark and it's all a struggle. And I think people talk about that a lot online, but it's really just like, I almost think we overlook things that come easy to us. So like, I remember some of the first things I written, they were so simple and fun. I'm like, well, it's too simple. It's too easy. But it's more about just your approach to it. And a more granular thing is like, If I write a to-do list of 10 things, it's going to cause me stress almost all day. If I write a to-do list of 3 things, get those 3 done, I may still do 10, but my mindset is not off all day. I think it's almost that simple. At least that's the day where I'm like, the days where I'm stressed out, I'm like, I'm either trying to look at some big problem that I haven't broken into pieces, or the same with my checklist or whatever. And it's just like, you haven't done those things that, you know, deep down are like most important to you.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you do to make writing more fun or more playful?
That's kind of, I think I got in this bad habit from working for clients, as like, I saw that this thing worked. And it would be like, I would tell someone, say, hey, I'm going to get you a chapter of this. I'm just writing a book right now. So I'm going to get you a chapter of this book on Friday. And then usually like I'll do a little bit Thursday, and then I'll like grind Friday, and then accountability helps, but that's the tortured martyr, right? Mm-hmm. So if I go back to what I kind of just said and do like my 3 other things, I'll inevitably have some time in the day, and it's almost like I trick myself into doing it. I'm not even in the same room. I'm on the couch, and I'm just writing notes in my phone. This is not writing yet. You kind of trick yourself into like taking action, and then it's just like kind of easier. And that's all important too. Like when you do sit down to write and like, you know, put some pressure on yourself, you got something to start with. It's not just the blank page, and then you're just staring at nothing for a period of time.
Yeah, that makes sense. So kind of trick yourself into doing something simple. Yeah. And then you also said you need to aim beyond what you're capable of achieving. What does that mean to you?
I think it's huge. I mean, there's the thing of, you know, reaching for the stars and landing and all that kind of old quote, but like I'm doing a pretty giant thing now. It's like whenever I try and think of like what seems out of your grasp, if you just start to kind of think about the small pieces of it, you can probably figure it out. And some of this took me a long time to do. Like there's a movie poster behind me, actually working on my first movie now. I'm doing a documentary, I'm interviewing people, all this kind of stuff. That seemed like crazy, and it still kind of seems crazy. But when I like really just broke it down in a very logical way of like, okay, this is how I would do this. And I think the other part is like, it's just kind of an experiment. Don't put so much pressure on yourself to be successful. Just put some pressure on developing the process, but the results are out of your hand. You know, it's like when Pixar comes out with movies, they don't finish films, they release them. And it's almost like you're taking it away from yourself and just letting it go. And I kind of think of it that way.
I like that. So just focusing on like one step at a time and not worrying about the big overall thing. That's nice. And you also said that when you don't know what to write, you might be close to something remarkable. That when ideas come easy, those are no good. They're not original.
Yeah, it kind of goes back and forth. There's a mix of that, because it's like sometimes I almost think it's like you can't see what's most personal to you, which is very odd. It's like I'm working a little bit. I've been talking and interviewing some different writing coaches now. And it's like there's a big difference in like reading a book and talking to a coach when it's like a therapy session. They're going to point out something you don't see. But I think digging deeper, asking yourself weird questions. I got some questions in the book from like Ron Holiday and Tim Ferriss that they regularly ask themselves. It's almost just like ways to think a little bit deeper about something. And when you start to see that perspective, and it's probably the thing you don't want to write because it's so personal, I think when you lean into some of those things, you're going to find something unique, as opposed to like, oh, Secession just came out, I want to write Secession. Well, Secession already came out and it was amazing. So to go write something else, you know, like to write something that's your version of that. I talk a lot about screenwriting, but it's funny because it's like things are so similar and so different. 2 of the biggest shows last year were Yellowstone and Secession. Mm-hmm. And they're both about billionaires giving their everything they've built to their 3 son or 1 daughter. They're like the exact same story in very different worlds. And I think there's a lot of that, but just like I think write what you know. The false thing about that is like, I'm a janitor, I should write about being a janitor. It's really like, is it a father son story? Is it about a struggle in your marriage? Like that's the part you know. And then the world that you create can be something totally different.
Yeah. So do you think when you make it more personal, then those are when things are like the most original, or they hit others the hardest? And I often find that when you take something very personal, becomes more universal, like more people can grab onto it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely like you start to kind of see it, you know, you start to see some things there. Like I've been doing some writing now. It's like a little like more blog posts and more personal. It's about like having a 1 year old and being married and trying to figure out all this stuff like that. And you kind of find out things about yourself because you really don't know a lot of the things until you start to write them. And I also like to think of it as like, I'm putting this thing out there and I can look back on it in 90 days. I'm like, do I have the same thoughts? Am I still stuck on this? And you kind of start to see those things. It's like kind of a public diary, which is kind of a little intimidating, but that really helped me like do the other things and kind of get back in the habit of like the daily writing, which I don't always do. I always do something creative, but like film editing or working with a client or whatever. These are all like very different things, but I'm kind of just getting back the habit of like the actual daily writing and like starting to enjoy it. And I think part of that is like the fun as well.
Yeah. So, yeah. So you've got to put out work consistently. And in the second part of your book, you also talk about finding your voice, which I think is elusive to a lot of newer authors. Yeah. But you talk about getting limitless inspiration and keeping what you call a commonplace book, which I thought was really interesting. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so this is like, I'll show you like, this is my second book now. And there's a stack of note cards. It's probably like another 1,000 sitting next to me. So I use like a Ron Holiday system. It's just like, I read a ton of books. When I wrote Ink by the Barrel, I probably read a book a week. And this was like during COVID and stuff like that. So I was reading it more than usual. I was reading like a book a week. I was doing a bunch of interviews. I started to dissect them more. One book leads to the other. And when you start to kind of just organize your thoughts, like this is a commonplace book. It's just a pile of 3x5 note cards. I do it manually. I'm sure there's very other ways to do it with tech. But for me, there's just something else that's different about it. I always kind of go physical. My movie here, I've got on like a cork board. I've got something else written over there. So I like to go to move things around that way. But that led me to like figuring out some patterns in my interviews and books I'm reading and discovering things that weren't there. And then you're kind of just connecting the pieces. It's way less pressure. I think too of like, I just interviewed Rich Cohen, who's a great writer who writes kind of in a similar vein. He calls it reverse engineering. So like the examples he used were like Malcolm Gladwell has an idea and finds a way to support that idea. That's the way they teach you in school. This is more like, I'm coming up with a series of conclusions and then like, and then that led me to be like, oh, this is all about being prolific. Like I really didn't know what it was about. And the second book I'm writing now, it's like, at some point it really hit me that like, I wanted to write a book for people that how to create leverage from scratch. That's a basic idea. What's the value in like finishing your next draft or your next whatever? And then I just like, I didn't really know what that was. I just started reading things and writing things and putting notes together. And then the idea kind of just came out of that. And, you know, the Malcolm Gladwell is probably a better way to sell books. So if you're in it just to write one book for your life, that's probably it. And his books are great. I'm not saying anything like that. I think they're harder to write, though. I think it's harder to go about it that way, that kind of school method. This is like, I want to write a book like every 2 years. So if I'm just doing this, this is a way to do that. And it's also going to be sustainable. And then I think I'm going to connect with people and hopefully they're going to grow. And if you read them in order, they're going to grow over time. You'll kind of see that way.
Yeah. I find this fascinating. So I want to dig into this a bit more. Yeah. So our listeners can't see. So you just showed me a literal stack of index cards. Yeah. So I read that, you know, you can organize them by theme and by category. So what do you do with this stack? Like how do you organize it, or do you not? You just kind of shuffle through it.
Yeah. So right now I'm doing so many other things that it's more like throwing them in a pile. I've just got stacks, and like to go back to the habit part, like I just want to write one a day. And normally I'll write a lot more, but that's kind of a minimal effective dose. So at the end of the year, I probably got enough stuff to get a book started, or the end of 2 years maybe. And then somewhere in between that is like what you see like in the chapter headings of the Ink by the Barrel. So anybody listening can get this free. We're trying to give away 100,000 copies this year. So it's free at brockswinson.com. But I kind of started to see like, okay, this is a really strong idea. Defend your time. Okay, so maybe that's its own part. And I studied a little bit about like, you know, what are good structures. I would say, if you're getting caught up on that, though, I like to think about things like that. Like, I'm going to give myself like a day to think about this, and that's going to be it. I'm not going to think more about it than that. I want to see what Ron Holiday does, what Mark Manson does, what Tim Ferriss does, whatever. Kind of see that pattern. And most books are broken down in three parts. So I kind of start to see, okay, there's that. I do, and I've been a ghostwriter on like 10 books too, so I've got that other like added benefit of like seeing the value and the way publishers look for things. And then it's kind of, I want to break it up into other pieces, and it's just different ideas that I kind of start to put together. And then it's like, is it strong enough to support a whole chapter? And these are like, this book's very quote heavy. It's very much like me looking to other people and kind of borrowing ideas. I call it borrowed authority because I don't have a name for myself. And this is also where you find your voice. Like if you talk to comedians, they're like, yeah, when I first started, I went up there and I sounded like Jerry Seinfeld, but then you're just testing things out. You're doing the same thing as a writer. So you're kind of like, the commonplace books lets you figure out what your ideas are. And then you'll see something like, I had some anecdote about like a, there's an anecdote in the book about the lion can hunt field mice all day, but it doesn't sustain him. He needs like the antelope to sustain him. It's about putting your energy in the right things is like the metaphor. And just this line that came out of that was like, hunt that which will sustain you. And that like carried me through the whole chapter. Like that's a book, that's an idea that I wrote based on someone else's idea that kind of stood out to me. So like Defend Your Time is chapter one of the whole part, you know, that's about time. And within that, it's like Ruthless Prioritization kind of fits in there. Annihilate Writer's Block kind of fits in there. Avoid Self-Sabotage kind of fits in there. Make Your World Small. Those are just different ways to kind of focus back on that theme of time.
Yeah. And you kind of talk about not really worrying about what you're writing down at the moment, because they're not for you right then. They're for your future self.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a pile. I mean, even I probably use the majority. I probably use 80% of what I would kind of put to the side. But I've talked to a lot of like fiction writers who do this. If they write historical fiction or something like that, they're the opposite. They'll throw away 80% of it because they really don't know what's going to be there. But that's where a lot of the magic kind of happens. So I interviewed like the screenwriter of the show Vikings. He talks about just the magic of the footnotes. He'll read a book, but then the footnotes will have something that's like, oh, like this is a whole episode about whatever this weird thing is. And it's kind of the same thing. You're just looking for those little nuggets that are going to surprise you. And like in movies, it might be a twist at the end or something like that. But you're just really, you're gathering information to kind of have it. And then you kind of go back and forth between those phases. And that's another, that's probably the biggest thing that stops people is not understanding, okay, now I'm in the research phase. Now I'm in the writing phase. Now I'm in the editing phase. And when you start to combine those, you're never going to get anything out. You're like doing too much at one time.
Yeah, you definitely don't want that editing voice going when you're writing. Like, that's not the time. And you quote John McPhee, who says, often it's difficult to frame much of a structure from your notes until you write a lead, which I thought was interesting because I'm usually thinking about my fiction books by starting with the end. But this is hunt through your mind for a good beginning, then write it. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. And I think one other thing too, is just like kind of thinking about these now, it's like some of these ideas are going to contradict each other because it's so many different sources. And, but as a reader, like you're not going to be the same writer today as you are 10 years from now, because the goal is to be prolific. So, but writing a lead though, I kind of think like he's probably talking more about nonfiction books and shorter pieces. And that's very true. It's like 100% true in a short piece. And he's also thinking like, about grabbing someone's attention from the very beginning. I do think it's important, but it's almost more of a curiosity type thing. I think he means like you need to know your theme, your idea. Like, so in writing screenplays, I just kind of discovered this recently is like people are maybe familiar with the log line. It's kind of the pitch of the story, but there's actually two. Now, if you're amazing, you might just squeeze it into one, but it's really, there is a sales log line. That's kind of a mystery. That's what gets it sold. There's a developmental log line. And in reality, that's just your North Star. So as long as you have your North Star and know where you're going in whatever piece you're writing, it's a poetry or a full length movie or whatever else, you kind of need to know what your thing is. When I look at like, I write books and short stories and all kinds of stuff. But when I write movies, I think about this very specific thing, like almost across the board. And it took me a couple scripts to kind of figure out what this voice was. But I like to write troubled anti-heroes barreling towards a violent catharsis. Now, that's a very specific thing. And then all of a sudden, all your choices are binary. It's like, does this lead me to who I want to be as a writer or does it not? And I think that's kind of, that's the importance of the lead or the theme or where you're going with your story.
Yeah, that makes sense. I like that a lot. The other thing you said, and I've heard the sentiment from a lot of pro writers, is that your work should be surprising, but inevitable. And yeah. I'm curious what that means to you.
It's so hard, right? It's like, I think like the best movies do it. I don't want to spoil some movies, but if you've ever seen a Christopher Nolan movie, I haven't seen the new one yet, but almost all of them are like at the end of the Batman franchise, we kind of expect to see Robin. We don't know how, we don't know who he is. We only get like a second of who he might be. But I think it's stuff like that. I mean, and that's kind of borrowing from a, 100-year franchise or something, but that is part of it. And in your own work, it should be the same kind of idea. And it's probably going to go back to your theme or your lead line or whatever that beginning thing was. I think that's kind of what's there that should stand out to you, but not be the most obvious answer. And a lot of that's just brainstorming and coming up with ideas and then figuring out what has to happen. Like, why is your character pulled into that particular universe? Why are they the right person for the job? And then where does that kind of go? Like, what is that going to, is it going to change them? Is it a comedy or is it a drama?
Yeah. And you talk about that. I think you call it deep preparation, about really focusing on the central dilemma. Is that mm-hmm. something that you look at in your work?
I think it's like, the weird thing is, it's like, the more you do things, the more you can start to break rules, right?
So yeah.
I like a lot of, I probably read one or two of the actual screenplay books, but I've talked to hundreds of screenwriters. So they kind of fill you in on some of those things. And a lot of the craft is like, it's good for people who don't necessarily like to write, but they want to be a writer, if that kind of makes sense. Yeah. So it is nice to like break down an outline or a story and feel like it's completely done and complete. And a lot of that's there. And I would encourage people, young people that haven't really written much, to do that and do it for your first couple. But I'm almost lying to you, because you're going to break it later, but you need to know how to break it. So you need to like understand it enough to kind of change it. And I'll do it more like today, if we're going to write a horror subgenre, I'll go watch 5 movies within that subgenre. And then I won't look at anything else again. It's like, I want to get enough to like, what does the audience expect? I don't want to like, let down the audience. But I want to kind of like just know enough of where I want to go and then kind of make it my own still.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important to know that, process is always evolving and changing. And that's how we're growing as writers, right? I don't think anything is ever the same that I do twice, but maybe that's a lie.
Well, formulas are comforting. Like they're very comforting. They're very nice. I hadn't published this yet, but I did an interview with Ed Solomon. He does a lot of work with Steven Soderbergh. They keep just like breaking the mold. They're just doing like multi-vantage stories that are twisting and turning. There's a picture of Ed Solomon like in his office, and there's probably 1,000 sticky notes weaving in and out behind him to try and figure out a 6 or 8 episode series and how he can make something completely new. And the outline, if you're looking at it, it works. Like it works technically, but once he starts writing it, he's got to let the characters kind of make some of their own choices. Like things are inevitably going to change. So it's more just like, are you being playful or are you being tortured? It kind of comes back to that. It's like how much you enjoy the different parts of the process.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I know like sometimes people who don't outline are like, why do you bother to outline when you don't follow it? Like, I need a roadmap to try and get where I'm going. I don't know.
Yeah, you need to at least know you're going west or east or something, where the starting point is.
Exactly. You also talk about time away from the desk, which I think is important, because a lot of writers who are working hard and grinding all the time can burn out. So you encourage taking some time off so you don't hit a wall, and just kind of letting your subconscious work on your project.
Yeah. And some of it's literal time off, especially if you do like one thing. If you just want to write novels, you definitely need some breaks in between the next ones. I probably bounce between projects more than like taking time off. It's just kind of switching the mindset a little bit. But I definitely think it's like, it's super vital to have those breaks during your day, during your year, whenever it is, to kind of recharge however you need to. But because you're also not, if you're working so much on your own stuff, you're not bringing anything in, you're not changing and adapting, and you don't want to write 10 versions of the same thing. Even if you're successful, I think that's like, that can be a fault of success, and I think to like find some joy in your work, you're going to be constantly adapting, and you're going to have some breaks to not just reset, but also like bring some new things in.
Yeah. So you said that there's sometimes more to the story that can only come from time away, which I think we all know that that happens. You know, you're just out for a walk or in the shower and you're like, oh yeah, this. So
yeah. It's always like, oh, it's so obvious. That's the title. Like, why didn't I think of that? But, and some of it's almost like you're now an editor on a foreign piece of work, even though you may have written it. If you wrote it months ago or a year ago, I just talked to some other writers. They wrote a movie called Sharper. This guy wrote a first act in college and left it in a drawer for 10 or 15 years, made it as a screenwriter, and they say, hey, this is not bad. And then they went and rewrote the rest of it after that. So you never know like when it's going to stand out to you. Supposedly, that's how Huck Finn was written. There was success of Tom Sawyer. He wrote a little bit, didn't like it, didn't know where it was going, and then it changed over time. And some of that's you. Like there's, when I'm in my 20s, I'm writing single guy stories like Judd Apatow. Now I'm writing more like responsible father figure stories, you know, and stuff like that. It's just your perspective is very different. And that's something that might come into play later.
Yeah. It's amazing the way you write kids before and after you have them. And then you, when you read, you know, books that you like, this person doesn't have kids.
Right. Yeah. These are kids who are just, there's placements in the story. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. And you also talk about embracing risk, that the only way you're going to discover your voice is to take new leaps, new risks.
Yeah, I mean, this is a big one for me. And I think it's like, part of it is just, and this is part of the book I'm writing now, so I'm just like obsessed with this idea. It's like everybody wants to get somewhere and hand the keys over. They want to get there. And because at some point, it's like we heard, you know, Ashton Kutcher was discovered in a mall or stories like that. And you think you're going to be a writer that's going to be discovered that way. I don't even think that stuff really happens anymore. But you have to be the type of person to go all the way to the end with your project, and you're going to face more and more risks the further you go. So like I'm like raising money to make this documentary and figuring out every little piece of it and figuring out how to make an audience. And then it's like, I'm not looking to hand the keys over. I'm looking for people that when I talk to them, I can say, hey, I'm going to take this thing across the finish line. If you want to be a part of it, that's amazing. But if not, I'm going to go do this thing anyway. So that inevitably leads to just a ton of risk. But it's also like it's perceived risk. It's not really that risky. It's just like stuff you haven't done before. But I mean, you know, don't, you know, put a parachute on, don't just jump out the plane, but like just plan a little bit and then take those chances. They're just like little micro steps. And just don't do something you know, can't come back from, I guess, is the craziest part. But most of it is just perception. It's not real.
Yeah. And I want to get a little bit into the third part of your book process. So you're quoting Jessica Sharzer. You assert that the writing phase is the cheapest phase.
Yeah.
I love that. Tell me what you mean by that.
Yeah, it's like it's hurtful and kind of rewarding at the same time or beneficial at the same time. So especially in films, right? So she wrote a movie with Blake Lively, and you know that's like a multi-million-dollar movie. So even if she's at a point in her career where she's making a bit of money, it's still just ink on the page. It's still just like printing out a version. That's kind of going back to like, is the outline the best you can make it? And then is the first draft the best you can make it? And the second and the third and the fourth. Then when you go to film, and I think a lot of people wrongfully think that, you know, you film it exactly how it is and there's no mistakes and there's plenty of time. Like all those things are not true and things change a lot. But you don't want to be like, oh, this character doesn't work when you're on set with your famous people and doing these things when you could have fixed this thing back in the office or back in the writer's room. That's kind of the biggest thing of like the cheapest phase and yeah, not worrying so much about it.
Yeah, I love that a lot because, you know, I don't write for film. So that was just such a wonderful thought exercise. And I think for any author who's like, oh, maybe one day this will be a movie. Yeah. The writing phase is the cheapest phase. You got to get it good before it goes into production, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. So as we're wrapping up, like you said, you're giving away 100,000 copies of your book this year and people can grab that at rockswinson.com.
Yeah, that's kind of the wild goal and everything. I've just updated the site, so everything's there. You can get the book. It's the book and the audiobook at rockswinson.com. There's also some challenges we're doing. We did the prolific writing challenge that actually kind of pairs with the book. So it's a video course that goes along with it. So it's me kind of explaining some of these lessons in more detail and also some clips of my interviews with like Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Judd Apatow and some people like that. So it's very like packed information just to help people like. The goal is to be prolific. So hopefully this will give people the starting point to be prolific.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you also write for Creative Screenwriting Magazine and you have a podcast, Creative Principles. So if you want to plug any of that, feel free.
Yeah, everything is on brockswinston.com. Lots of stuff there. And I'm also, I do some coaching. I do some like social branding with people. I love working with writers and kind of like helping them get their greatest work into the world, or actually their most ambitious work into the world. So I love trying to do that myself and then working with other writers who do that. But everything's over at brockswinston.com.
Fantastic. And as we wrap up, I just have one question. If you could pull any piece of advice from your book for a new or aspiring writer, what would it be?
I mean, the biggest thing is, probably something we've already said, but it is the writer and the editor phase. I think that's like, if you're sitting there and part of that is like, I'm going to write the next great American novel, you're putting so much pressure on yourself. You're not going to get anything out. You know, it's admirable to try and be the next J.D. Salinger or whoever you want to be, but you can't do it that way. Like, you have to start with kind of a bad draft, and to get the bad draft out, you have to separate the writer from the editor, get the words on the page, change rooms, change hats, whatever you got to do, but separate those phases, and then you'll actually see some work start to kind of dribble out.
I thought Brock had a lot of interesting things to say. Let's talk about ruthless prioritization, being selfish at least a few hours a day. What do you think about that?
I think you have to, right, in order to get the job done. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's so easy to get distracted, you know, doing this. And, you know, like right now I'm outlining a new book, and it's definitely more efficient, and I know the book will be better because I'm creating an outline, but I don't enjoy the outlining process as much as I do the writing process. So I am looking for any possible excuse to get up from my computer and go do something. Like I got excited about emptying the dishwasher this morning. You know, and like, I know I shouldn't be doing stuff like that. I shouldn't be getting up from my desk, but you know, that's basically what he's talking about. And like, I think we all need somebody cracking the whip. You know, and it needs to start with ourselves.
Yeah.
That's why I've been doing the streaming, online streaming in the mornings, because for a long time, that was my set time to write, period. But there's something about the expectation of there are other people there waiting for me to get online that has really driven me to be like, this is my prioritized time. I am doing my writing work. You can sit there and watch whatever, that's fine. But like, there's this interplay between the two or multiple people that are there of this is time to write, period. This is time to do that work. And I think without that, I would definitely find time to look at the dishwasher.
Yeah. I like, you know, he said, harness the power of boredom. We've talked about that before. Neil Gaiman does that. I also liked how he talked about being selfish about the things that help you write, like exercising, those kind of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he suggested, which I love, overcoming writer's block by being playful instead of struggling. What did you think about that?
I know for me, like when I get hit with anything like that, usually the second I sit down at the computer and start typing, you know, even if I'm typing gibberish, usually the answer will come to me. The answer rarely comes to me if I get up and I'm still thinking about it, you know. So if I go to like empty the dishwasher and I think that I'm going to be able to come up with the idea in those 5 minutes and I'm off doing that, that usually doesn't work. The only time getting away from my desk actually works for me is if it's, you know, something totally different, you know, and my subconscious just kind of throws it out there. You know, which is why I go for a walk and a run and things like that. You know, like my mind is completely taken off in another direction, and that seems to open that up. But I think all of those things are valid ways to do it. I think, and everybody should try all of them because until they hone the one that works for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he's talking about aiming beyond what you're capable of achieving, which I thought was interesting and got him to break down a bit more, you know, and he's not talking about thinking about some outlandish, lofty end goal, but just focusing one step at a time. And like, I'm interested.
Well, I think he actually, he said easy ideas usually aren't original, right? Wasn't that his phrasing? And that is very true. So if you know, you paint your character into a corner and you come up with some idea to get them out of that corner, if it's a fairly simplistic thing, if it's something that comes to you very easily, chances are it's not going to work. If it's, you know, because the reader is going to pick up on it too. Oh, that's the easy way out. I'm going to do that. You know, so you have to come up with something out of left field. You've got to surprise the reader. You've got to surprise yourself. I personally paint myself into a lot of corners that are really, really tricky. And sometimes it may take me a day or two, you know, multiple attempts to try and figure out how to get out of that. But I eventually will. I think this is partly why the AI stuff doesn't work. Like if you're trying to use an AI to help you write something, because everything that it throws out is predictable. you know? So like, it's too simplistic. I think an author needs to be able to surprise themselves and surprise the reader in order for it to work.
Yeah. One of the best, like representations of that, for a fantasy reader like myself is Brandon Sanderson's work whenever he does the hard magic systems, because there are hard set rules about that magic system, and he will put characters in a corner where they have to solve that problem using these hard set rules, and there's no other way to like weasel your way out of that situation. Like, you have to follow these rules. And to kind of play off of that idea in whatever you're writing, and, you know, think about what your character has gone through, what tools do they have in their pockets, like what makes that situation different and unique than just the average person being there.
Yeah, I mean, to give you an example of that, I just finished another book, and there's a scene in there where I've got a character, he's locked inside of a semi trailer, you know, so one of those big, you know, metal boxes. The only thing in there with him is a chemical camping toilet. So I literally pulled up the specs on chemical camping toilets and figured out what materials were in there. You know, what could he possibly use in order to get out of this scenario? You know, and there's ways to do that. Like, I was able to do it using the chemicals that are actually in there. The right mix creates a certain type of gas. Like, there was ways to use that. I've got another scene where I've got somebody, you know, that's operating on somebody, and they need a plastic tube, but they're not in a hospital, and they end up busting a coffee machine open and taking that, mm-hmm. you know, out of the coffee machine. So, you know, just look around your character's space, figure out what tools are available to them, and use those. I think it's all kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely think innovation with tools and with ideas. I mean, I've known this forever, but sometimes I forget to do it and I'll just go with idea 1, 2, or 3. But really, if you just force yourself to grab paper and write 10 to 12, you'll get some pretty cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He also talked about the commonplace book, which I thought was really interesting. I can really see how that would work in nonfiction and fiction, but just like throwing all these ideas into a book and not worrying about what your premise is. Like, you're looking to come up with a conclusion, to discover what you're kind of dancing around. It's like, put it in, don't worry about it. That's for your future self. What did you think about that?
I couldn't do it, because, I mean, honestly, it feels like it's an easy way to hit the word count, right? You know, like, just type and type and type, knowing that you're going to take it out. I overwrite no matter what. Like, even if I've got an outline in front of me, I always overwrite the scene. I overwrite the book, and I end up taking a lot away when I go through on that next draft. But for me personally, it simplifies it. Even though I'm doing that extra work up front, you know, being able to cut away is much easier than it is to try and fill. I've never been able to take a short book and make it longer. It's always the other way around. It's very easy to take a long book and make it shorter. I think if you could definitely do what he's talking about, but you're just brainstorming, right? You know, you're throwing that filler in there, and then you just take away whatever doesn't work in the end. As long as you do that exercise, it's a valid option, I think. Some people tend to leave that stuff in there, you know, because it gets into that, you know, 60, 70, 80,000 word count. They feel they've got a full novel. So they leave all that fluff in there. And I think a lot of people, you know, that's a mistake.
I think too, like, what that reminds me of is stream of consciousness poetry, stream of consciousness writing in this sense. And I think there's a place for it. I think that there's probably, I mean, more than likely, there's an audience for it as well. I don't think I could pull that off. I think that that involves a high level of trust in your ability, to do that and to still captivate. So it's definitely not for me.
I thought it was really interesting just because it's the reverse of how I usually do it. And you, JP, being the story hypothesis king, you know, you're like, start with your theme, your armature. Mm-hmm. But this one's kind of like, throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and then figure out what that is. So I was like, yeah, it might be a fun exercise. Maybe I'll try it sometime. But yeah. I also thought it was interesting how he talked about the difference between a sales log line and a developmental log line, like one for sales, but one that you're actually kind of using as your North Star to guide your writing. You have thoughts on that?
I come up with one. So every book I've got a tagline. I usually write that tagline down, and it's, you know, I attach it to my monitor, so I see it every day while I'm working, or it's at the top of my Scrivener document. I guess I can see the reasoning for having two, you know, one for yourself and then one that you kind of share with everybody else. That's just a little bit more fine tuned. I don't know that it's necessary, but again, everybody's process is different. If that's working for him, then then that's obviously what he should do.
Yeah. I mean, like, I have the really fast pitches of what my books are to try and convey as quickly as I can. Usually it's a media mashup because I'm trying to think of like, how can I get the most amount of people to understand what this is about in the shortest amount of time. But then if they're interested, that's when I really dive into, okay, well, this is what it's about. Like, this is why you might be interested in it. So I think that's how I see the differences between the two.
Like those comp mashups. It's this meets this for a sales log line versus, I get that. The other thing that was kind of humbling, I guess, is when he said that the writing is the cheapest phase. When he's talking about movie production, he's like, it's just ink on the page. Like, words are cheap. You got to fix it now before the movie gets produced, which I didn't feel too great about, but it was a lot of food for thought. I was like, oh, wow. Yeah. Sometimes we take this too seriously. And if you do have future hopes that somebody does something with this, you got to do it with the ink.
Yeah.
Well, I think that comes out of the screenwriting world. If you ever get the chance to sit in a writer's room while they're working on a television show or plotting out a season for a television show, they do a lot of this. So they'll come up with, multiple strings of where that particular season could go. And then the entire, usually there's a group, it's 4, 5, 6, 7 people all in there. And, they'll throw an idea out at, idea A will go towards this line, and this idea will go towards this one, and this will go towards that one. And they'll just kind of see which of these series actually gets to the finish line. And they can be completely, different storylines altogether. Same characters and same world, but, they're taking them off in different places. And then they try to whittle it down and eventually get to one. But I've seen as many as like 3 or 4 different storylines all being hashed out for one season of a TV show until they figure out which way they want it to go. And then they focus on that one. So I think that's where that's coming from.
Yeah. He had a lot of wisdom. Is there anything else in particular that struck you that you wanted to chat about? How about giving away 100,000 copies of his book? What did you think about that? That was his goal for free.
I'll take one, right?
The businessman in me just said, no, can't do it, because that's 100,000 people that are no longer buying that book. How big is that audience to begin with? I think, what I've seen, because this is obviously, it's a big thing in the indie, world, right? You give away that first book in a series in hopes that they're going to, move on to the second, third, and keep going through your series. The truth is, while that will build your mailing list, people, if they get something for free at the get-go, chances are they're not going to pay for whatever comes next. They'll take it for free happily, but they're not going to start shelling out money for something that, to continue something that they got for free, because there's other options out there that are free. So they'll just jump on something else.
Yeah, actually, JP and I were talking about that this week. When you're in KDP, you can do like that countdown and your book is free for a few days. So we were talking about advertising, and it's like, it's difficult to get people to find your books. And I'm like, even when I'm not advertising, they seem to find it when it's free. So that is definitely, but I'm not sure how much they fall through the rest of the series, but that is definitely an indie strategy. All right, good stuff. So with that, JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Lucinda Halpern. She's the founder and president of a Manhattan-based literary agency. She has 15 years of experience in book publishing, and she also has a new book coming out on February 6th called Get Signed, Find an Agent, Land a Book Deal, and Become a Published Author. So she's going to share a few tips with us.
Yeah, she had lots of great tips to share. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.